How's it going, everyone? It is me, the Lone Vault Wanderer, and we are here with episode 144 of the Ham Radio Podcast.
And it's me, Carrick, with ACG. Thanks for joining, everybody.
Thank you. I'll explain my absences for the past couple of weeks. Each time Carrick and Maddie, they wanted to get a particular guest on, and the only time that that guest could have recorded was when either I was at work or asleep at like 2 in the morning.
Beddy by time for loan. Absolutely. He didn't find us important enough to wake up for, I guess. I don't know.
2 in the morning, Carrick.
Oh,
so I said, you know what, if you want these guests on, I'll happily miss those podcasts. But I'm here now, and Maddie isn't here because he's got some previous commitments. But Carrick and I, we have a big, big week of news. It's been pretty interesting. What do you think, Carrick?
Well, I do want to say that if people wonder if it's just a random thing, it's not. You should check out what Maddie's doing. It's pretty fucking cool.
Absolutely.
And it's something that I like. It's easy to cut people down all the time. And I've seen people in the post be like, why is this person gone and this person gone? And it's like, I'm going to tell you right now, compared to my reasons, almost all the reasons that Maddie has given, you know, to be gone and you have given have made sense. This one makes more so. You should check out his Twitter. But basically, he's going to Edmonton to play in a true tournament for hockey, which is something the dude has dreamed about for a long time. So you should celebrate that and not be so hard on him.
Maddie.
I know he feels it.
No, seriously, it's actually awesome news. I know how much Maddie loves hockey. It's like the only sports thing he talks about with me, and that's about it. But good luck to Maddie with that. And Carrick,
so
we have some Mafia 3 Hangar 13 news to talk about. So Hangar 13 is the developer behind Mafia 3. This was a studio that was essentially brought together for this game. This was their first game from memory. It did very well sales-wise. It did okay, you know, critic-wise. And their publisher, 2K, has decided to lay off a number of their staff. We don't know how much they're laying off. As far as we know, the studio had about 150 staff before all of this went down. Maybe it's below 100 now. That's all speculation. Who really knows?
Yeah.
But we wanted to talk about this layoff and what it might mean, because if you remember, we had a podcast about this months ago about how I essentially said that it has to be Hangar 13 that's creating, for instance, the next BioShock game. And now that they're laying off staff, what is that going to mean? Who knows, Carrick? What are your thoughts?
Well, I find it interesting that they said their last prototype was a fighting rhythm-based music game.
Oh, it sounds like BioShock all over.
Yeah, exactly. When I read that, I was like, okay, well, I guess we were wrong on if it was ever going to be BioShock. They were making, like, you know, some kind of Def Jam, you know, Guitar Hero mix. But we do see companies, you know, at the end, we've talked about this, like a 30% reduction, 40% reduction when something's done. Their last DLC was this summer. And I got to admit, I wasn't a huge fan of Mafia 3 when it came out because of the bugs. And they did a good job fixing some of them. And their DLC was great, by the way. Which, I mean, like a good level above the main game to me personally.
Yeah.
So it is surprising. The only thing I can assume, and it is all assumption, is that for whatever reason, they didn't get Mafia 4 as their next game. They didn't get BioShock. Yeah. They did, were told, do what you want. And they did. And somebody at Take-Two looked at it and was like, I don't like it.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, like, the game, again, did very, very well. I mean, it was one of 2K's.
5 million.
5 million, one of their most best-selling games, you know, in recent memory. But you have to think, is that because it's just a Mafia game and the market was right for that and people really wanted it? Was it because it was a good game? Because I'm leaning towards it being more that it was the Mafia brand, and that's why it sold so well. Because the game itself, looking from critic reviews and even looking from your own thoughts about it, Carrick, it seemed okay, like a solid game, but nothing crazy. And maybe, here's the thing, because 2K could have looked at that and said, all right, we need to scale down. But as you said, scaling down is a normal part of the process. So we'll never know the true reason behind this.
Yeah. And also, yeah, I mean, the game, I would agree with you that the name matters a little bit too, because I know some friends who bought it just because it was Mafia 3.
Exactly.
And then weren't happy with their purchase. And then I know some people who were. But I think we see it with Kingdom Come the same way, where people will overlook certain things as well. And they'll just be like, well, I just want to get it for whatever reason.
Hmm.
it was very interesting that it had a black protagonist as its main protagonist in Vietnam, a Vietnam era. And I thought that was cool because I think that nobody was expecting that. And it turned out to actually one of my favorite parts was the main character and just the different ways in which the world was set up. Yeah. But 5 million sales never in the one thing I think everybody should remember is the sales never indicate what it sold and what price it was at.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that I do know that there were some deals. It wasn't a Games with Gold, but I do know that there were some deals, and it's like, did they look at it and go, we sold 1.5 million at our price point, right?
Yeah.
And then we sold this many. And then we don't know how many people bought their DLC. Maybe they saw a huge drop off. And that's why you and I didn't talk about this prior to the podcast, and I'm just remembering it now. So sorry for dropping this on you, but I'm a little pissed because my personal belief is we need to stop throwing first-time developers on major titles. It needs to stop at some point. And the more I see, I don't think that the disillusion of these guys is like, I think a lot of that is tied to it being Mafia 3. I mean, the expectations, sure, people might have bought it because it's Mafia 3, but their expectations are higher because it's Mafia 3 too.
Absolutely.
So it's like, I sometimes wish they wouldn't say, we've put this new team together, even if they're superstars. We've seen that before, and it's failed. Daikatana failed spectacularly, and that was some superstars. Like, what superstars don't really mean anything. They have to work together, figure out how their team works. Don't put them on Mafia 3, for Christ's sakes. Like, let them do, I don't even know what type of game you would call it, but maybe not that AAA massive game. I don't like to see them destroyed because the game had some bugs. Like, I don't know. Just bothers me.
To be frank,
bit.
Even have them work on an expansion for another title.
There
just,
you
just
go.
Just let them to get their bearings for a little bit. Because as you said, it doesn't matter how experienced. And mind you, this was an experienced bunch of people, you know, that worked on many different titles across. And predominantly, it was a lot of Bioshock work that they did. But, you know, they were experienced, but it doesn't matter how experienced or skilled a team is, because presumably they were. But they have to gel together as a team, and they have to work together for 3-4 years. And starting something, you know, to the scale and to the name brand of Mafia, that's a big deal, and that's massive. And it is no surprise that, you know, I think it was a 70 that game got overall, and the DLC was kind of eh. So it is unfortunate. It is absolutely unfortunate. And I know that 2K has said that, and this is usually what's said, mind you, every time there's a layoff, that, you know, we'll try and redistribute staff to other areas of 2K, and we'll have, I can't remember what the name is, I'm having a mind blank now, but they have kind of like programs to help people transition to other companies generally. They might even have like a studio day where other companies can come and check out their stuff and their portfolios. But hopefully, you know, the main thing from all of this is that I'm hoping that everyone gets a job again.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that no one leaves the industry entirely, because that does happen after big layoffs. But first and foremost, I do hope that they find another job within 2K somewhere, because 2K does have the number of studios.
And good games. So it's if you instead of going, I'm not going to mention any names, but instead of going to some podunk little place and being like, you know, scraping by, it would be nice if they got to take some of that experience also. I don't think we value mistakes very well. In this society, it's always about like, well, if a company fucks up, we'll fire the CEO. And then you realize later, you're like, we just fired the one guy who's got all the data. Like, really? Yeah. Shouldn't you just look at the system and say, hey, we're going to fix the system? But no one does that anymore. And if we do lose these people and they leave, then somebody who maybe goes, you guys, we don't want to do this because it didn't work in Mafia 3. Or if we do this, we need to do it differently because I got to work in a situation where that didn't work. That's what I want to see. It's great to say everybody we've hired is superstars, but at some point you have to be like, sometimes they're at a point where they can't remember their failures. They can't remember, you know, and then they don't work well because, you know, attitudes or, well, I'm a superstar. You know, even PR companies are calling us superstars. It's like, fuck, who cares? Just work together as a team. And I hope those guys also stay there, because I would like to see them take the institutional knowledge of failure, go, this didn't work, and then take it to 2K's other places and have that information.
You know, it's interesting, Kari, because this doesn't just happen in games. Like, the example that I thought of when you were mentioning that was sports teams. I mean, who gets fired when a sports team does bad in one season?
Exactly.
It's not the players. It's not the coaching staff. It's the coach. It's the head honcho. And it's not even like any of the board that make the most decisions, that decide how much money that the coach has.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's usually the coach. It's she's the fallback person. So it is unfortunate. I just don't know what this means for games like, you know, BioShock moving forward. Games like Mafia 4. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, dude. I'm going to be honest. I may not have loved it, but I was really looking forward to Mafia 4. And when I saw the news, I was a little bit gutted about it. I was like, fuck.
And also, getting a Mafia 4 from the team that did Mafia 3, learning from their mistakes, and then making that game. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. I think that's vital for the industry. I just don't think a lot of people, and I know some people, I was also thinking sports, so I know some people are going to be like, but sometimes the coach is the problem. That's true. Totally.
Absolutely.
What I'm saying is a lot of times, and I think what you're saying is a lot of times the knee-jerk reaction is to restore confidence via just a fucking destruction of everything. Yeah. It's like, I'm not 100% sure that's the way you want to do things. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I hope they land on their feet, man. And I don't know, BioShock, Mafia 3, those are two of the big names now that it's like,
And I'm trying to think what other studio, like, I know 2K has a ton of studios, like so many. I just don't know where they have a big functioning team of at least over 100 people that can start to work on another game. Because I can't think of any. I genuinely can't. I would have to research that.
Yeah.
So, it is unfortunate. Do you have any final thoughts about this, Carrick?
No, just that I feel that it'll push out one of the series I actually was sort of interested in seeing before versus others.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another controversy. Valve has banned a developer after the developer's employees left fake reviews on Steam. So essentially, Incel Games, I had never heard of them, but they've created online titles, mostly multiplayer games. They were banned because the CEO of the company told his employees to leave fake reviews, essentially, on their games on Steam, so they would be seen more favorably by the community. Now, obviously, that is against Valve's terms of service heavily, and Valve not only like just banned this developer from uploading any more games to Steam, but completely removed all of their games from Steam entirely. So, what do you think about this, Carrick? The face.
So here's I don't want people thinking that I'm. It's hard to describe. I just want to make sure people understand. So it sucks to be an employee there. And the reason why is if your CEO is emailing you saying we want more reviews, that indicates you didn't do as many as you should have, which probably indicates you don't agree with the philosophy. So someone, whoever leaked that email, probably knew that was the end of their job, because if you pull your games off of Steam, you're done. So that sucks, because if you're Joe Blow and you've programmed the game and, you know, you're pretty, you know, you maybe like it somewhat or you hope it sells somewhat well, and then your boss does this and even starts asking ever for you to write reviews, you know, you're screwed. So I think that part sucks. So it sucks for some of those people that probably refuse to do the bad things. We actually talked about this prior to the podcast about like your own code of ethics. Like, what are you okay with? Yeah. And some, obviously, the indication is some people were not okay with it because he had to demand them. He even told in the email that if you don't give me your receipt for your game within 24 hours, we're going to have personal discussions about why you didn't buy this game. Like, that's belligerent as fuck.
Absolutely.
So that I think sucks. But I think that's the only thing Steam could have done was remove. There's literally no other tool for Steam.
So. And talking about the employees, I mean, let's say some of them were there for 6 months to up to 2-3 years, however long. It's hard to put that on a resume now and to say, I'm going to go try and apply for another job. Think about it. You put that name on there and then people are like, oh, you know, I heard about this. What happened? Why'd you leave? Blah, 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 blah. Did you put up fake reviews? It's not a good look for the employees. Obviously, the company's now done because they can't. They literally cannot do the thing that they were created or incorporated to do. But I mostly feel bad about the employees. The CEO that was,
he's a jank.
That's a good way to put it.
I mean, come the fuck on. Yeah. At some point you have to know that'll get out too, right? Like, we joke about this all the time. Like, people say, oh, there's, the industry is doing this behind the scenes, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, nah, it's not behind the scenes, because you can't keep a secret. Somebody's going to leak that fucking email. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened here. There's and that was a small company. Trail. Yeah. There is always a paper trail or Reddit investigating you. So, yeah, man, it's like I, that's the only thing they had, though, right? Is just to remove, like, there's no other tool for Steam to really take. They can't red. They don't have a system for, like, saying there's questionable anything. They could have deleted all the reviews, but then, you said,
have no trust or confidence in that.
You have no trust or exactly, and so it's like might as well just hit the delete button. And yeah, I didn't even think about the resume thing. I was like, how would I describe that? I guess I would say I worked on this game, and then hope.
Dude, I wouldn't even put it on my resume. Mm. I'd say I went on a holiday for a year.
Where you been for 2 years? Sabbatical, man.
Sabbatical, it was pretty fun. Yeah. I went on a mission.
exactly, man. I was in China on a mission. We're good. Yeah, it's sad.
Dude, no, it is absolutely sad. I mean, and here's the interesting thing. I mean, what... I would have done the exact same thing that Steam did, but... I wonder what kind of internal policies they have around this, because let's say a developer, kind of wrongly, does it with one game, a couple of fake reviews. Is that in and of itself enough to completely ban a developer from Steam? But or, like in this case, it's with multiple games and tons of employees. Like, where is the level at which Valve is comfortable enough to kind of ban a developer entirely from Steam? Because it's a big deal. It would mean that your company is screwed. You have to reincorporate it. Maybe Valve sees your name. Like, Phoenix Company is a thing. Like, Valve is going to see your name as the CEO of another company, and they'll be like, well, we're not comfortable with you joining Valve or joining Steam now either. So that CEO could be tainted forever because of this.
And it could also be the situation where we've seen it with asset flip games on Steam, when those get banned and stuff, where the company just remakes another, you know, LLC or whatever. And so you're like, wait a minute. So technically, we're not really banning the company. We're banning the person. Because if you find his name somewhere else or her name, and then you're like, oh, shit, we don't trust them. You just have to keep banning them just as they remake new names for the company. It sucks also because no matter what now, that draws like a focus and attention onto those particular things, which I think with some developers, they just want to make a game and get it out on Steam. And now you have this extra, I don't mind extra focus on those. I just, the negativity, it's already negative enough, I guess. It's like the CEO fucked it up again for multiple people, you know, not only his people that work for him, but sort of the smaller groups that release maybe a game that's not the greatest. You instantly question every review now and just be, oh, they were obviously paid by the company to release it. It just sort of sucks.
And it's a tough situation because on one hand, you want their user reviews on there to be legitimate. But on the other hand, you need to be able to have user reviews that are really accessible and that anyone that uses Steam can actually do a user review. So that kind of flexibility and simplicity and ease of doing a user review, that's exactly what's bitten Valve in the first place.
You know what I mean?
Because it was so easy for that company to say, you know what, everyone do a fake review. Whereas, and this is why I want Steam to push the critic reviews. Like, what do they call people like Total Biscuit?
Curator. I have one as well.
I think Maddie may.
I don't know.
Yeah. So it'll be even better to, I think personally, push the curator review, and even in, companies like IGN and stuff that I think are curators anyways, push those scores. I think place them on a different pedestal than simple user reviews. Not because user reviews are always going to be illegitimate. I'm not saying that, but review bombing is a thing. This is now a thing. Yeah. I mean, it's tough when you look at a game that people say that's really bad or that's really good, and it's just completely different. You're like, well, what the hell just happened? You know?
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, I think the system, like, you can't win, so you have to sort of find some middle ground. But I think that right now, the one that they've chosen over time just continues to bite them a little bit. I don't know what they can do. The curator thing definitely does help. I don't use it as much as I should. I always forget, but it's the reason why I forget is because it doesn't matter anymore than a normal.
I thought they were going to make changes.
I guess if it, they were, and they do something weird. I can't remember where, like, they supposedly show them easier. But of course, if you sign in as a curator, you don't see like a non-curator does. So, you know, it's hard to even know where you lay. But yeah, it's just that Steam's having a lot of like, it's not even growth pains. I don't know what you'd call it, but like they're having a lot of little issues where when it was smaller, things you could get away with it. And then as Steam is the thing, has been for many years, we just continually see these, like the review bombing because people are mad that a translation isn't done or something. You're like, well, wait, but are you reviewing the game at all?
Well, content like, is cut, or it's just, you know, it's another agenda.
Yeah. 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 It's definitely difficult to sort of parse out. Right. I don't think you can parse it out. I just think that Steam just also needs more people.
And YouTube. Here's the thing. I mean, when looking at review bombing, I really like the graphs that they put in. So you could kind of like determine, all right, very clearly at this time or from this date range, there was a review bomb. But that's not taken into account in the overall score. So when you, let's say I'm going to Google Fallout 4, for instance. When you see the score on, you can see it on Google search results, that overall score will include any review bombing. And the only way to exclude review bombing is to go down to the graphs, pick a specific date. Not everyone's going to do that. Not everyone's going to, like, everyone's going to look at that overall score and say, all right, is that good or bad? All right, move on. That's how simple it's going to be. And it's a really complex issue because, like, how do you always determine something's a review bombing or not? I remember, the movie Black Panther is out this weekend, right? And there was kind of going to be a concentrated movement of fans to downvote that on Rotten Tomatoes for whatever reason. Like, they had a certain reason for their view. And the Metacritic was like, okay, we are going to ensure that that doesn't happen. And then when I said, oh, look how great the reviews for Black Panther is, everyone, you have no idea, Carrick, how many people tweeted at me, oh, alone, it's just because they got rid of all negative reviews. What are you talking about? That was just in terms of user reviews, if there was going to be like this big groundswell of negativity for like an unjustifiable reason. And that's a problem because now what that's doing, similar with Steam, it's causing a breach of confidence in the system.
Yeah. I didn't know anything about that.
No, but
That's weird. Yeah. I mean, and that is the thing is that once that gets out, that the lack of confidence just stays forever. Yeah. Like forever. Because somebody will always bring it up. You can have 10 people talking and being like, hey, man, we're going to go see this. And one person will be like, yeah, but did you hear about this? And at least three people who originally were for something will be like, oh, well, I didn't know that. And you're like, but go check if it's right. Like, Jesus Christ. I mean, if I say that if you pay me $1,000, I will cure all your cancer, it's not 100% sure. Yeah. Like, it is weird that some people would just be like, it's on my tweet. Must be real. Twitter showed it to me.
It's on the internet.
It's on the internet. It must be real. You're like, okay, man, whatever.
Yeah.
It's just a really weird system with all review. I think all review systems are having this. Even my own, anybody's, or not my own, but worded ones. Hmm. It doesn't matter if it's worded, if it's numbered, whatever. They're always susceptible to this kind of this kind of misuse, whether it be internally in the company or externally from people. And you just sort of have to understand context. Yeah. I don't think people want to. I think a lot of people don't want to. They don't want to look at why somebody gave something a 77. They just want to see a score.
They just want to see a score. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a different topic entirely. But we can move on from that. The next piece of news, which was a big surprise, everyone was like, "What the hell just happened?" THQ Nordic bought Koch Media for £121 million. Or euros. I don't know what that symbol is. I think it's euros. And that means that THQ Nordic, this kind of revived THQ, now owns, what is it? Saints
Deep
Row.
Deep Silver.
Deep Silver, Saints right? Row. Which Deep is Silver, a publisher behind Metro. You know, Metro Exodus is coming out.
Kingdom Come Deliverance.
Kingdom Come Deliverance. Dead Island.
Yeah.
Man, like, Metro, what were you like saying before, Carrick? It's gone full circle now. Hasn't it?
Yeah, because they originally sold Saints Row, and to see it just sort of come back is like, wait, what the fuck's happening? And like I told you, I mean, and this is my fault, but I thought they were much smaller. So when I saw the purchase, I thought the person had messed up the tagline.
Yeah.
Like I was, you mean it's the other way around, right? Because Deep Silver to me has been doing fair. I don't mean their games have been doing well, but they've been. Talked about this in the podcast. Yeah, they've been releasing a couple, right? So you're just like. They must be bigger than THQ. What does THQ Nordic even mean? Like, who is that? And then you find out that, you know, I think it was 150 million. The question that I have for you is, does 150 million seem freakishly small?
It does. Yeah, I was like, this is Deep Silver. We're talking like they have some big, big games.
Yeah, yeah. And Metro is, looking to be.
Is it looking to be one of the best games this year? One of the biggest games, yeah. Absolutely. And you're right, Carrick. Like, I think everyone was seeing that improvement of Deep Silver over time. Like, their public relations is really good. Their community management's really good. They were doing pretty well as a company. And obviously, it's over 100 million euros. Like, it's nothing to scoff at. You said it's 150 million US, correct?
Yeah,
or something
right.
around that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, yeah. That's nothing to scoff at. But they do have... Literally, Saints Row, Dead Island, Metro. Those are massive games. Like, those are fully fledged AAA games. Plus all the other stuff, like, what's The Blob that they were mentioning as well?
The Blob?
The Blob was THQ Nordic. Sorry, that was a mistake.
Oh, okay, gotcha. They did. They have a Revolution, Homefront now, I would assume. The Homefront series as well. Yeah. Deep Silver, they've had some stinkers. They've had some mediocre and some good games, so... The thing that's weird to me, though, is just so many titles. I never thought 150 million would be enough. It's just, a Dead Island didn't maybe set the world on fire, but it's been on the 360. Then it had a sequel. Then it had a remake. It had the PC version. And then they showed trailers for the second for a sequel. So that obviously has some interest around it. I guess 150 million just seems small for some reason. I don't know why.
It
just seems like such a small amount.
And plus, it's all the everything else that they own. It's all the employees. Yeah. You're right. I think it did seem a little bit small. But what do we think about this? Like, what do we think about THQ Nordic owning all of these great games? Like, I love Metro. I just don't know how. Like, Deep Silver was doing such a great job with Metro. I don't know how this is going to change, if at all. Like, I assume there's nothing changing for Metro Exodus, but moving forward, I don't know. What do you think?
It feels to me like there's a higher chance of Saints Row, which I know a lot of people don't like, and Agents of Mediocre, or whatever the fuck that game was. Agents of
Mayhem?
Is it Mayhem. I always call it Agents of Mediocre, so I forget the title now. But that game, it was. And so I want to see a Saints Row, so to me... This excites me to maybe see them say, hey, we're going to do a Saints Row again, because I think GTA 5, Mafia 3, a lot of these games, GTA 5 has its own issues with being super expensive for people to do the online and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah. And we haven't seen a new game from them. You got Red Dead coming out, but I would love to see a Saints Row. I think there's a space for that. I think Metro is their big, it's a confusing purchase because they're not like the biggest sales games in the world, but there's a lot of them. And Deep Silver is, it feels to me personally, I don't know about you, but every time I turn on a game, I swear to fuck, I see Deep Silver.
You're right. Yeah.
So it's like every time I turn on a game, I'm all, oh, it's Deep Silver. Oh, that's Deep Silver. Okay. That's also Deep Silver. And I'm like, well, shit, man. They're sort of prominent. It doesn't mean they're great. It just,
but they're popping up everywhere. And just for, clarity, I did pull up the games that they have. So they also have Shenmue 3. I didn't even know that. So Kingdom Come Deliverance, Shenmue, Dreamfall Chapters, Shin Megami Tensei, Mighty No. 9, they did that. Homefront, as you said. They did Right to Hell. That's something we can
Oh man. Maybe that's why it was only 150 million.
They did Stalker, but maybe that was just a publishing deal. I don't think they own it. They've been popping up everywhere, and I don't know how I feel about it. I genuinely don't know how I feel about this.
I think maybe they also take smaller games, right?
They
do. Is there any smaller game list there? Okay.
Dakar 18 is something that's listed here. I guess Mighty No. 9 was a smaller game. It was kickstarted. Sacred 3, whatever that is.
Oh, dude, Sacred?
Yeah.
No shit? Oh, yeah. Okay. Sacred's Diablo clone, I guess you'd call it. Sacred 2 and 3 were actually considered by a lot of people to be really fun games. So
now it's interesting because I don't know how many of these games Deep Silver just publishes or also owns the rights to as well. I know that Deep Silver did just a lot of straight out publishing deals. On one side of it, it is good. Like, it is good that a company like it is Koch Media, and then through that, Deep Silver. But it is good that they were able to secure their future. I mean, The CEO is just laughing now. I think she's just going to be like, yep, I'm pretty much like, I'll work with this company for a little bit, but my future is secured. But also, like, and that's the reason I do like acquisitions in that sense. Let's say that CEO was looking to wrap up her boot, like hang up her boots, rather. Knowing that she secured the future of the company and the employees,
yeah, right,
and then through that their families, like, that is always a good thing. Like, you never want a CEO that just kind of leaves a company to fend
swinging in the wind,
exactly.
Yeah, so,
and now that you have THQ Nordic backing it up with their finances and their resources, I think for the future of the publisher, it is a good thing in the end. I just don't know. Like, I'm a bit not worried, but just curious as to what changes are going to be made to Deep Silver, and how will that affect their games?
Yeah, and I'm looking at THQ Nordic. So they've holy shit. Okay,
they have Darksiders, don't they?
Yeah, and they bought all of Joe Wood, which includes Gothic. It includes Aquanox, which I would love to see a sequel for.
Yeah.
Then they bought Dreamcatcher. So holy shit. So then they bought all the THQ stuff. Nova Logic.
They got 1,600 people. That's a big studio.
They did Rad Rogers, which is a little indie game coming out, which is actually not bad. Yeah, they.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's almost like when you get and I guess it's not almost like, it really is this, but you get two or three B tier publishers. And we've talked about Deep Silver in the past being B tier, but sort of prominent and doing a lot of things. You see them at events, for example. Like, I don't know about you, but like when even going to a PAX or an E3, they're all, you know, there's a Deep Silver person somewhere. So I think it's that situation where you find out it's like the two B level people are coming together. And I don't know what it really means. I mean, for Metro, they're probably not touching any. I mean, I would assume they're just like
wrapped up. Yeah.
Status quo. Yeah. And then Kingdom Come, I'm sure this purchase makes them happy as fuck, because Kingdom Come sold fairly well. It's 500 million or 500,000.
That's what I'm saying. Like, that's the best selling game of all time.
Well, just beat GTA, bitches. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it'll be more interesting to see what interests me is what they'll bring. What will they bring up from their old IPs? Will we get an Aquanox sequel? Because Subnautica is doing really well. Aquanox is also an underwater sub shooter game.
Yeah.
Like, do they look at that? That would be great.
No, absolutely. They've got so many games, THQ Nordic. Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Well, because you mentioned it, Carrick, I think it is a good segue to talk about Kingdom Come Deliverance. And especially what this might mean for THQ Nordic. So, how is the game? I haven't played it personally, obviously. How is it? Do you think it's lived up to expectations? I've seen news about there being bugs and issues, especially with the save files. But how is it going? Is it good? Do you think, you know, people got their money's worth with it?
Yeah, I don't know. So I rated it a wait, but only mostly because of the bugs and, you know, some of the, it is a little bit more cumbersome. I think it is good. And I think that a lot of people feel like they got their money's worth. But I think at the same time, especially, you know, where you randomly see people talk about it, I think a lot of people also then, like, are a little bothered by those bugs because they're pretty egregious. They're not really, I guess, for example, and I heard somebody say, well, it's not any buggier than Skyrim. And my comment to that was, do we really want to say that we are happy that a game released today is as buggy as a game released 4 or 5 years ago and has twice as many interactables? Because almost nothing in Kingdom Come is interactive. In fact, nothing in Kingdom Come really is interactive unless it's something you can put in an inventory. So, for example, in Skyrim, you walk in, shit's bouncing everywhere. We've seen those physics bugs. If you've ever walked into a room and like the broom is fucking bouncing, you know, because some physics issue happened. But it's all interactive. It's all stuff you can grab and throw and move around. There's none of that in Kingdom Come Deliverance. Also, Kingdom Come Deliverance is empty, completely. I mean, almost completely empty, devoid of life. So your towns are filled, but if you walk out, you'll see maybe one trader total walking. You'll see the occasional guy walking. You'll see a deer sometimes. So you got to go into it with a different thought process. And I think a lot of people did. And I think that that's the best part, is that those guys were like, okay, listen, it isn't Skyrim.
Yeah,
it looks a little like Skyrim or Oblivion, but trust me, you're not going to have 8,000 bears fighting off a fucking troll And in fact, you're going to have nothing. You're not going to have a lot of wildlife at all. And yeah. I think a lot of people felt that they got their money's worth. But the bugs, dude, the bugs are so weird because...
Are they game-breaking? I guess it's because you were mentioning Skyrim before, and I don't know what Skyrim was at launch anyways, but
right.
a lot of the bugs that are still there to this day, they're not game-breaking. And like people joke about Bethesda games being buggy, but like if they're not game-breaking and they're only like, oh, the ragdoll physics are a bit off here or whatever it is,
sure.
then I know a lot of people will tolerate it for that. So is Kingdom Come just like minor glitches, or are there some very severe ones that are actually putting people off the game?
Oh, there's some very severe ones. There's one in particular where if you can go on a quest and the guy will be like, hey, man, I've got a horse. You don't, you know, bitch, like you're going to have to run. And you can say, well, no, I want a horse. And if you do, he'll give you one. But if you don't, he thinks you have one and you'll fail a quest later on because he'll be like, go chase that guy. And you're on your foot going, what the fuck? I can't get to it. Or you have the ability to fail. One of the Discord people had that failure happen. So there's some bugs. Another person I talked to was walking in a village and just died. And so to me, that's game breaking. There was no health, you know, elements. Most likely what happened was he had a texture that was, a part of the nav mesh was out of order, and he fell enough or into something and it killed him. We've seen that in some games.
I was playing Dead Space the other day and that happened.
Kingdom Come has a lot of those, like steps. I have it in my video where there's multiple steps and multiple castles where you can't get over the top step. You have to leap over it because it's glitched.
Right.
And for everybody, that's something that they're fixing. So I think that there are some game breaking. I think that there's not as many as other, you know, crappy titles. But what is interesting to me is what people will deal with. I think that's a psychological thing that always interests me. It's like somebody will say, well, Mafia 3 is too glitchy for me to buy. But they'll be like, I'm going to buy Kingdom Come.
Yeah.
And I'll be all, wait, you know, like, I want to know why one is acceptable. Is it because one's kickstarted? Which I do believe. That that does impact your purchase decision.
I think when a game is kickstarted and you kind of like, you're wanting to see it succeed because you're putting money into it so early. There is a different threshold in terms of, or tolerance level, I guess, in terms of dealing with bugs and glitches and stuff like that. And we'll talk about this later on, but System Shock, for instance, is in a Kickstarter. Like, I've kickstarted that, and whenever that game comes out, if there are issues with it, I'll be like, you know what? They're going to fix this. It's fine. Like, I want to see that game succeed. And it's a little different when you're dealing with, like, maybe a fuller priced game that you just expect to run well. I think there is that little bit of a different dynamic. Out of curiosity, how much money did this game run on Kickstarter or raise on Kickstarter?
Oh, I think it was $1.3 million.
So it was pretty substantial, but I'm still assuming that they were getting funding elsewhere because that's not enough.
Yeah, and I think that Kickstarter. I think also, and so that anybody doesn't mistake what I'm saying, I gave it a weight, which actually is not a bad rating at all. That's actually a good rating. It just means that they only did 1.1 million. So
it's definitely not enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure somebody doesn't think I'm like this not, because there's so many elements to like. But here is the crazy thing: many of the bugs. So they're bugs and not stoppers, which if you understand like QA or testing, a stopper would mean we can't certify this on the Xbox.
Yeah.
We literally can't. We're stopped. So they don't have those, which is great. Or at least, you know, we haven't really run into them, but they do have a lot of the weird bugs like dying randomly or, you know, but the thing is, it's a bug, right? So you could play it for a year. I could play it for a year. And
yeah,
if we both recorded, we would have different bugs.
Absolutely.
So I've had people say and they're watching, they're like, I don't have any bugs. And I totally 100% believe them. And then somebody else will say, I have a bunch. But to me, what it indicates is this is a game that is looking at a certain focus, sword hand to hand, right? Realistic world, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately, some of their bugs impact the very gameplay dynamics they're trying to say are unique. And when that happens, then you do have to go, okay, should this be $60? Because or should it had, if it had 3 weeks, I think we'd be in pretty good shape. The reason why I say that is because even the lead dev this morning said, we've decided in 2 weeks we're going to release a big patch. And I'm like, well, if you waited 3 weeks, you could have released it to Kickstarters or something and just been like, only Kickstarters get this.
Yeah. I still guarantee, though, even after that big patch, the game's still going to have issues. Like,
it for sure would. I had headless people all over in my game. Yeah, like, just, yeah. I have it in the video. Like,
but that's a game feature. It's just like Harry Potter, Headless Nick.
It was funny. I thought it was funny. You know, Chuck Norris is your dad, which is awesome. When you look at your dad in this game, it's, I swear to shit, it's Chuck Norris, or they modeled him up it. But it's got so many great features. To me, the reason why I would like 3 weeks is so that we didn't get bogged down in this discussion.
Yeah,
that's the problem, is we continue to see it, dude. Mafia 3 with 3 weeks have at least alleviated some of this shit. It's starting to bother me where we're getting these games where it's like every single time. And remember, this is a game that had a 23 gig day one patch.
That's massive, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's huge.
Yeah, it's I really enjoyed a lot of elements of it. I think that, you know, $60 though, it depends on if you have the money, right? Like, you and I have a different thought process than like somebody who's well off, and I have a patron who's well off, and he was like, hey, it's got bugs, I'm going to buy it, because he thought that was funny. and I'm like,
wait a minute.
Okay. Yeah. I was all, man, dude, to me, that's sick. I mean, that's a lot of money to just put down on a couple bugs. And he's like, nah, it'll be fun. So yeah. Some people, we just have different monetary levels too. So
absolutely. And that's why, and this is kind of like moving to your review, I guess, mentality, Carrick. That's why I really appreciate that you actually buy the full game, because without a doubt, and I'm going to admit this, whenever I get for instance, Assassin's Creed, I got that from Ubisoft because I was streaming it. Because I didn't pay for it, I was absolutely more tolerant of the frame rate issues, whatever the cause of those were. Was it the DRM? Was it something else? I don't know. But on my old PC, like, that game would tank even with a lot of the different assets turned down to normal or medium or whatever it is. The frame rate in that game was really, really inconsistent, especially in towns. And then I got a new PC and that fixed it to an extent. Like, even on my really good GTX 1080 Ti, that game would still drop like in towns. But because I didn't actually pay for it, I was definitely much more tolerant. But when you are putting down $60 for a game or whatever the amount is, and those issues crop up, you always think, damn, like, I wanted this to run well. Like, my other option was this game, and maybe that would have been a better experience. I mean, it's tough. And again, that's why I like your review mentality, that you'll always purchase a game. So when your review does come out, it's just different. Like, subconsciously, you treat bugs and glitches different than if, you know, you didn't spend any money. It was a review code or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, and did you realize we're both wearing the same shirt? Did you
that
on purpose?
I didn't, though.
Dude, that's awesome. Just so everybody knows.
Mine's Adidas. So,
yours is it. So is mine.
We actually both wearing the same Adidas.
Except you have a
hoodie.
And
it's different. That's fucking, it's hilarious.
I just noticed it. When I think that it is subconscious, and I think that what I did, especially when I created the review systems, I was like, I just don't want to have to deal with it at all. Whether I don't want to have to second guess even myself. I'm just going to buy it. And that way, I'm like, I did spend money on it, and it does feel different. I mean, I think you hear about it. It's even part of morality plays where somebody says, you know, free things are treated differently than things you work for.
Absolutely.
And so to me, it's a big deal. And I think that also maybe with Kickstarter, and I haven't checked the price, if Kingdom Come Deliverance, because you Kickstarted it, was only $40, then maybe your mentality is a little different, as well as just being a Kickstarter, where I think Kickstarter is a little bit more communal. You know, people are like,
definitely,
you know, it would not get made. This is what they think. It would not get made otherwise. So celebrate what got made versus what didn't get made. And I think that there's nothing invalid about that. It's not my thought process, but I absolutely can see why somebody else would think that.
Definitely.
And I'm cool with it.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
with Kingdom Come, will you get it, or is that not at all like your...
I remember actually having this discussion with someone in the Discord. I would need to play something like Witcher 3 before this. And even though they're not like, I know they're not like similar games, but they're overall the same theme. And, you know, like, I still view them in the kind of the same ilk. And the fact that I haven't played Witcher 3, like, I need to play that first before I play that. And even I'm trying to play Skyrim on the Switch, man. It just... I don't know what it is, Carrick, and I tweeted out...
Whoa.
I'm not talking bad, but I tweeted out about this the other day. I think I'm having an internal issue with playing very long games nowadays, because whenever I am putting in 50 hours or 100 hours into something like Skyrim, I'm always keeping, you know, aware at the back of my mind, oh, I could be playing another game. Like, I'm spending so much time on this one game. What else am I missing out on? And because of that mentality, I've swapped completely to playing much shorter games, like 15, 20, 25-hour games. Rabbids, so whenever a big game... Rabbids, thing. Yeah. But to be fair, I loved it so much, I put in 50 hours anyways. But whenever a game like Kingdom Come Deliverance comes out that is just so overwhelming in its, you know, scope, I'm assuming it's like a 40, 50-hour game, whatever it is.
Yeah, easily 40. Easily, probably, yeah. If you just did the main story and were pretty quick, you could get about 35, but
yeah.
45 is more.
And that's overwhelming to me, like, especially because I don't have much time nowadays in between streaming and all that kind of stuff and work. Sometimes I just want to play, like, I'm happy to play a short game and then move on to something else. Like, this weekend I'm playing Hellblade, for instance. 6-hour game. Then good I can game. Say I played another game and then I move on to something else. Instead of, like, I remember when I was playing Assassin's Creed Origins over stream, I only put 30 hours into it, but we had to take a break of playing Assassin's Creed because it was so overwhelming. Like, people thought, oh, we're seeing Assassin's Creed again. So we played Cuphead, then we went back to Assassin's Creed. And that was only a 30-hour game. I'm always really conscious of the games that I play and the length of them, and I am straying away from longer games. And something like Rabbids is different. I put 50 hours into it, but it's really a 20-hour game. Unless you want 100% it, then it takes that long. Same with Super Mario Odyssey. I put 50 hours into that, but it's really a 20-25-hour game. So...
Yeah, I think that also is what confuses people on reviews a lot of times because they I will say this. I believe a lot of developers lie through their openly lie and say this game's 100 hours. What they really mean is if you walk back and forth parallel
across the game world
and do all the fetch quests and talk to every person in every line of dialogue, it would be that. And then you get these people going, it's only I fucking beat it in 15. What the hell? And I get both sides. I get the developer saying, well, this is all the content. And I get what I like is some developers lately have been saying, well, if you sort of rebound off of things and play it reactionary, just a normal gameplay, it's going to be this many hours. But if you do all of it, it'll be this many. I like that. With you and Skyrim, though. Here's what's weird and why I would actually agree with you, even though I like Skyrim and I know you do. I see what you were saying now. Skyrim is an older game.
Yeah.
And there comes a point where your brain is like, if I play, I like this game, but if I play it, I could technically be experiencing this other game that I haven't seen or played before that hasn't been released a couple times or what have you. And it's a new experience. So it's quite easy for a person's brain to be like, why don't I go play that? And I totally get you. I mean, I totally understand. Do you think have you ever beat Skyrim?
No, I haven't. And I think now I've put I think overall with all of my play sessions, I think we're talking about 40, 50 hours into Skyrim.
Oh, okay.
Like, it's not, no, like nothing crazy like that, but I've never finished it. And I was going to take the Switch opportunity. Here's what happened. Skyrim came out on the Switch. I'm like, I'm just going to play this and nothing else. Then L.A. Noire came out, and I'm like, oh, this game looks fucking awesome. And, Carrick, L.A. Noire.
Dude, I'm telling you, is it not? Fucking experience?
It was great. Like, issues with the Switch port, and I know we're changing topic.
Sure.
The shadows on the Switch, man, killed me. Killed me with that game.
Are they dithered like they're dots?
Oh, or they're like big squares.
Oh, okay, gotcha. that's not what I was saying.
And the problem is that when you're playing L.A. Noire and you're investigating a body, you're zooming in right up onto that shit.
Right.
And it's really noticeable. Like, I'm not a mark or whatever it is with shadows in games. In fact, I'm happy to play a game with low shadows, so long as it looks okay. But this was low was the highest, and there needs to be a different scale with this L.A. Noire Switch version. But whatever. That aside, though, really, really good game. I really enjoyed it. Loved the theme, the music. The music. Whenever you were talking about this character, and it never really clicked with me until I played it. Like, when you walk past a clue, and when you discover all the clues, it's just... It's beautiful, man. It's such a great game. And the story is... I loved it because you had independent quests, or I say quests, but let's say missions
mm-hmm.
or cases throughout the game, but you had this one continuous plot point that kept right. bringing itself up in the newspapers, and then in the final set of missions or cases, it all brought itself together. I thought that was done really, really well. I loved it.
So how did, I can't talk, I know L.A. Noire's got many issues, but I can't talk like positively enough about its experience as a whole.
Absolutely.
And when you were playing it, I don't know about you, but so to me, it was a little like X-Files, where X-Files has they call it the mythology episodes, which are your main story.
Yeah.
Side episodes. So that's a little like L.A. Noire. But here's the thing to me that I enjoyed so much, man. The facial tech animation, I get that it still looks goofy now after so many years. It's a little worse, but it didn't even matter if I got it wrong. It was the little things that they would do. And your brain is like, are they lying? And if you care, which I do, I would sit there and go, I rarely do that. Usually I'm like, fuck it. And I won't even stress it. That game had me stressing shit.
And sometimes, like with some characters, you could easily tell that they were lying. But with others, like they would answer a question, and it's just like a slight darting away of the eyes. That's the thing that indicates that they're lying. Because some of the times, on the Switch, it's good cop, bad cop, right? Not doubt or whatever it was. So sometimes I'm like, all right, I genuinely think this person is telling the truth. And then it's, no, you had to do the bad cop. I'm like, really? Like... Yeah. It looked so genuine. I wanted to believe this person.
Do you know who I failed on all the time? And I played this 3 times, and I still failed this last time because I couldn't remember. It's the chick in the jewelry store at the starting.
I mean,
in the first, I don't know what it was about, and maybe this just indicates that, you know, every chick I've ever dated could lie to me with reckless abandon. But she would be talking, and I would look at her, and she would do the eye thing, and so my brain would be like, lying, and then I'd hit it, and they'd be like, you know, they give you the audio feedback, whatever it sounds like. You're like, are you kidding me? And then you'd pick the other one, and you can't go back and look, so you can't, like... You can't stick on one thing and go, this is for sure always their tell, but it might be their tell. And to me, that's probably the greatest thing about L.A. Noire. And then I have to ask you a question that will define you as a human to me. Who's your favorite partner in the game? Because. And you don't have to name names if you can't remember. That's fine. But is there a particular partner you love?
All right. Really love the first partner. I thought he was just...
There was Rusty.
So, okay, I don't think I liked Rusty. I thought Rusty, in the end, was a bit of a dick. The first partner I enjoyed because he was funny and quirky, and, like, there was this one scene where he was like, yo, Cole, can I punch this guy? Like, it was just funny like that. Hated the third guy. Favorite was definitely the last partner.
So, Herschel Biggs.
Herschel, that was it.
Who you liked,
Because the reason why is, like, I don't want to give spoilers, but at this point, pretty much Cole is discredited, right?
Yeah,
and Herschel is someone that is the sole investigator, doesn't really work with people, and you're just chucked with him. Or I should say, he's chucked with you. And the way that their relationship builds and how he kind of takes Cole on and protects him from people, you know, saying things about him. And they just meld together in the end. Like I really, really like that dynamic. He was undoubtedly my favorite character. My favorite partner, I should say.
That's very cool because there was Ralph was Patrol. He started it. Steven Bukowski, Rusty Galloway, Roy Earl was Vice. And then Herschel was the last one.
Fucking hated and Roy.
And you also, it sounds like, hated Rusty, which I also hated.
Yep.
And what was weird about this, and so if anybody gets a chance, you should go and check this game out because it's not expensive. And it's not. And it's like Bully. It's something you should at least fucking experience. But those partners changed my entire feeling of the way characters should be done. And the reason why is because normally a game has a specific arc where it's like, you're a jackass until you prove yourself. Mm. This game was like, no, bitch. There's going to be multiple times where you're like proved yourself and somebody's like, I gotcha. And then the next time they're like, you know, I fucking hate you. And then people hate you because you're good.
Yeah.
And then people hate you because you fail. And your brain is always on. It's on alert for new narrative from these partners.
So many roller coasters in that game. Like you could be smashing out every case And you're like, yeah, everyone loves me. And you fuck up once. And then the chief is just like, Cole, what the fuck?
The man? Irish chief?
Oh, you
better start getting me heads, boy.
And I just felt so disappointed in myself because I chose the wrong character. Here's one thing that really pissed me off. There was this one case where you had to, you know those cases where you have to charge one person over the other person?
Yes,
there
hard.
There was this one case where I knew this guy was guilty, and the game glitched and didn't let me charge that guy, and I had to charge the other guy, and I knew it was wrong, and I got blasted for it by the chief. It was the worst thing in the world.
And he blasts you,
too. He demotes you and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And are we talking about the guy with the nose like this big? Yeah. Yeah. It's like fucking he turns to the side and you're all, that's a wind sail. But he I love that actor in real life, by the way. He's an amazing actor. And he, with that first time you fuck up. And I had played this multiple times and I was on my Xbox X, the X, I think. And I was playing and that fuck, I walk out and you're like, you know, you've come to the end of your questions. You didn't do well enough. You have to go out and then come back in. I go out and he's like, you better start. I can't remember what he says. He's like, you better start getting me heads, boy, or whatever. And I'm like, okay, sir. You know, like, sorry, man. You know, like that's my brain brilliant. Was like, he's really mad, you know.
And just all the subtle details of that game. Like, for instance, when you're making phone calls and there are these random blue police boxes in the streets, I'm like, surely that's just a game thing, right? And I Googled it, and they were real. Like,
those are absolutely real.
Like, there were blue police boxes that only policemen and policewomen could use back then that you could call dispatch and do whatever you needed because there were no mobiles. Yeah. And police needed a readily accessible way to be able to make calls and all that. I thought that was the neatest. And I never used the word fucking neat, but that was so neat. I absolutely loved that, man.
Did you enjoy the pace of the game? It sounds like you did because the pace is slower than I think any other game of them. But to me, that was the best part.
I think at times I thought it was dragging on a little bit, but I don't know whether that was because of the game or because I wanted to move on to something else. So I'm not criticizing the game too much in that regard. But I really do like here's the thing, especially because I'm playing this on my way to work. I really like how you could do one mission and then set it aside the game, fucking do whatever you need, and then you come back to it and you don't feel lost or out of it. I think the game does a really good job in allowing you to play like one case, finish it, and then you can walk away for it. Sometimes at a week at a time, I wouldn't play this game and jump back in and it'll be awesome. You know what I mean? So I really did like that. And again, like this is kind of similar to TV crime shows where you've got your... I'll call it Law and Order. Law and Order are usually independent, individual episodes where there is no continuing plot thread. Yeah. But then there's shows like Luther, which I don't know if anyone here has watched it. I absolutely love it. They have the times when he's dealing with individual cases, but there is always this one continuous plot thread throughout all the episodes and all the seasons. And that's the most compelling thing. And L.A. Noire had that. I think they executed that brilliantly. It wasn't just like you were doing a case and moving on to the next, and that's it. I think that would have made the game much more bland. But the way that it all tied together in the end, I thought was beautiful. It was fucking awesome.
And what about the, at least to me, I not only did I like that that's how they set it up, but sometimes a side character in the side quest would matter in a main quest. But to me, one of the things that sort of shocked me was I've rarely been really puzzled at a story and been like, I don't really know what's happening unless it's like a Japanese Resident Evil game, you know, where I just don't understand the mythology. But with this game, the newspaper stories, the first couple, I was like,
what the fuck is going on?
Dude, I was legitimately like, am I supposed to fucking figure, like, do I know this? And then you realize, well, of course, you know, you start to know right away. It's flashbacks. But it's like you start to realize, not to be, I won't destroy this for anybody, but you realize that Cole is not exactly anything as it's being represented as. Yeah. And that's when my brain, I remember the first time playing that going, oh. What? In one of the newspaper the flashbacks. And then from that point on, I was just constantly listening to everything he said. And it just it sort of creeps up until, like you said, at the end, some shit goes down. And I thought that was fantastic.
And
it was like
especially
True Detective.
With the like Cole's flashbacks when he was in the army. I thought that was just character building. But it actually meant something in the end with the story. Yeah. I fucking love that. And speaking of side characters, undoubtedly my favorite side character was Elsa. The actor, of course, was amazing. So, some Australian actor as well, and I don't know if she put on the accent or if it was just, you know, she did the mocap for it and they put that in. But she was the way she would talk and her mannerisms, like she was amazing, man. I loved it.
I hope everybody who listens gives it a chance if you haven't, because there's a reason why we're talking about. Well, we decided not to talk too much about Kingdom Come because Maddie will do a review, but. Once you start I just don't know how to describe it. It's one of those games that I think, like, if we were just sitting here yakking, you could talk about for a couple hours, not spoil it for another person in the room, but still have these. And it's rare. You just don't see that as much anymore, I guess. Mm. Like, there's something about LA Noire and the way everything comes together. And I get it's not the most amazing game in the world.
No, it's
I think it's that moment when you realize there are multiple pieces that just sort of go together and you can be puzzled for a little while and it's okay. Like, it's not a crime to not know exactly what's happening. And in fact, I think that game is 10 times better for not knowing.
Yeah. Like, and I will say as well, like, the subtle details in that game are brilliant. And if you're a Fallout fan, when you jump into a car and you're listening to a song that was playing in a Fallout game, that is the most awesome piece of nostalgia that I've ever experienced. Like, I remember this one time, and this was the first time it happened. I just walked into a store and the radio was on, and I'm like, I recognize that song. What song is that? And I would just stand there for 5 minutes listening to it. It was it was incredible.
Did you see the video of the he's passed away now, but the kid took his grandpa into the game, and his grandpa grew up at that time frame. Grandpa's passed away. It was about a year ago on Reddit, but the guy drove him around, and his grandpa was like, "That's these." That, like, it was all what his memory, he remembered, like, all these places, the tar pits and
that's
all these,
amazing.
He's like, dude, that's, and it was crazy. And that was actually one of the things. I made a mistake. I was doing a walk in the walk where I love the way the game spreads out. You can see people have different economies in that area, you know, bad slums near the train tracks, that kind of thing. But one of the things I had brought up and he actually corrected me on was, like, the Hollywood sign is fucked up. Hmm. And I can't remember what it says, but it's the old name. And I was like, oh, that must be a joke. And then the old guy was like, no, it's not a joke. That's what it said at this time, at blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, hey, what the fuck? Really? You know, and they took so much time. If you go and look at storefronts, holy fuck, the storefronts look real. First of all, they're really well done. But you'll see, like, signs racially or sexually, like, you know, discriminatory.
That's
back
what the
then
time
or
was,
for now. But back then, that was the time. And you, like, when it'll say, you know, certain people aren't allowed here and stuff, and your brain just, you're not used to seeing that right now. Like, it doesn't happen now. And you see it and you're like, whoa, what the hell? And the way people talk about the different people and stuff like that is just, it's such a good character.
And even the way Roy Earle was treating Elsa, and I won't say specifically, but you know what I mean? Like, when that happened, I was like, what the fuck? And Cole was doing nothing. Like, Cole.
Yeah, exactly. Come on. You're just sitting there going, what is happening? Yeah, it was so fucking well done. If people get a chance, man, I think it's like, I don't know what it is. I think it's like $23 now on Switch.
And you know what? I think on Steam as well, there's a Steam sale going on. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's on sale right now, even by the time that the recording gets uploaded. So yeah highly recommend that game. It's amazing. So that was a good discussion.
How the fuck did we get on? Sorry, I probably started that one.
No, that's fine.
We were talking about Switch games.
and now there's a segue. So Nintendo, as the final news topic, has teased the appealing benefits of Switch's online membership. And they say, in their words, I think our next announcement will be worth the wait. Now, this is interesting because, Carrick, we've talked about this time and time again.
Yeah.
Virtual console, when is it coming, blah, 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 blah. But and this could be something else completely different, but here's my speculation. They're talking about an online membership and saying our next announcement will be worth the wait. While talking, you know, with that context in mind, could Virtual Console, instead of being one where you just buy games outright, it's like a like Netflix or like Xbox Live's system where you're spending $20? Like, I think there's still the $16 a year or whatever it is for the regular, you know, Nintendo Online stuff. But what if there was an increased cost for being able to play online and also have access to all of these virtual console games. Could that be what Nintendo was doing, or would it be something else entirely? What are your thoughts and speculation?
No, that'd be... it sounds really bad, but anytime I think something positive about Nintendo, they really go out of their way to do me wrong. So it's like, I mean, when it comes to our online, but when it comes to our online service, so I don't know. I mean, it depends on what it would cost, dude, because one of the things that worries me is if Sony's got a subscription, Netflix has a subscription, Xbox, EA, and now Nintendo, it's like at some point you're all, fuck, man. I mean, each month I am buying a game. You know, I am spending $60. And for people who don't have a lot of money, it sort of sucks. I think with virtual console, it could be that. But did you see the leak 2 weeks ago where they found the working GameCube emulator for the Switch?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, yeah.
So what I've wondered is, would virtual console come like the classic where it comes in waves maybe? And they're like, okay, virtual console NES is here.
Yeah.
Virtual console SNES is here. Virtual console GameCube is here. The only reason I bring that up is because that is a Nintendo emulator. So obviously it's just for the GameCube, which then makes me wonder, like, why it's not one big emulator that does all their games, especially because of how they do their hardware.
Well, and I think
I don't know.
They do have their NES or the SNES emulator already on the Switch, because I believe some of the games that are on the eStore are like old classic Mario games that run off.
Oh, that's true.
I think they do. So don't quote me on that. But I will say about the whole, you know, if they were to release NES games first and SNES, I wouldn't want that, because I really want 64 games. Like, I want to play Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask so bad that, and I think this is what they did with the Wii. I hope that they just bring out the best of the best first for each of the consoles. So for SNES, it'll be Super Mario. For Zelda, for 64, it'll be Zelda. For, you know, GameCube, it'll be Wind Waker and all that kind of stuff. Like, I want the best of the best to come out first. And then, you know, start to really go back through the old back catalog and see what you can find. Because I was looking at the Wii U store's virtual console the other day. There are some games there that I'm like, what the hell is this? Like you find your typical Mario Karts and Pokemon and all that, but some weird, obscure old games that I would never think of in the first place, that maybe that I want to play, that I don't think they're going to be released straight away. I think it will be the heavy hitters. But I don't know, man. I just want them to start somewhere. If we get something, I'll be happy. Because
I just want something. I want to. And it just dawned on me. I guess they probably. I don't know how GoldenEye would work because of the IP.
Great game.
The IP is owned by
Microsoft.
Is it owned by Rare and Microsoft? Yes. Yeah, so it's like, fuck. Do they? You know. So you have to look at that, because Microsoft themselves even have problems with getting IPs for their backwards compatibility. I'm hoping, dude, that these aren't just Nintendo games. That's, I guess, what I'm saying. Is my hope is that it's good third party too, because most of my experience with those systems may have started with a Nintendo title.
Yeah.
But they did not. That didn't frame the entire time with that console.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, it framed a very small amount of time.
I'm thinking games like, as you said, GoldenEye, Perfect Dark, Killer Instinct,
Rogue Squadron.
Oh, dude, Conker's Bad Fur Day. Fuck.
If Rogue Squadron and Conker's Bad Fur Day were on the Switch, I would never play another game.
Conker's such a good game.
That game is awesome.
Oh, man. I just remember how delightfully violent it was when playing the multiplayer on 64. Such a good game.
And that's the thing, is like, a lot of their games were also online, and it just started, or at least it had just started getting the online. I want to know how they're going to handle that. Like, if there is a GoldenEye, you can't do 4-player split screen, which is the way it was originally set up. Like, how are you going to, like, are you going to be able to play against somebody online, which I think is a big deal. Their multiplayer was probably the biggest deal of GoldenEye.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what they do. I hope they take the fucking, you know, shackles off or whatever, and just, you know, like, start doing some surprising new stuff, because I would play it so much more.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, when you said that, oh, I hope they get third-party support, I'm thinking, yeah, they probably will. Like, especially with Rare, because Rare has so many great older titles that are on Nintendo consoles. And then I thought, well, Microsoft, because they own Rare, they've been pretty good. I mean, Minecraft is, you know, you can play on the Switch with people on the PC. But then I thought, well, what happens to Rare Replay? Because that's doing, and it's done pretty well on Xbox. Does it affect bringing games on the Virtual Console that are Rare owned to the Switch? I don't know. I hope not. But it's a worry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a worry. Like, that's, I guess that's the thing is, it's, you never quite know exactly what what Nintendo themselves are, like, going to do, how much hardship they'll go through, too. Because, like, Phil Spencer's talked about it with Microsoft. He's like, dude, we have driven across country to different fucking storage units to find the IP papers in somebody's, you know, like, somebody who's defunct now. And they're like, I think I still have the papers that say I own this IP. Let's go find them
in
the storage
unit.
Is Nintendo, and I hope they do, you know, will they work that hard? And if they will, then I think we will see a lot of those third-party titles that a lot of people remember. I know I remember, like, was it Mother Brain? That's an old RPG, but it's like some of those older games. I mean, I love Zelda, but there was a lot of games at that time mimicked it that were good too. And that's another thing, like, Nintendo seems to artificially hold back the number of titles where maybe Microsoft pushes because they don't have enough. Sony's in the middle. Nintendo's like, we'll release one game a year and we'll be happy, right? How is this going to happen? Like, how many titles are going to be on it? That's the big thing.
Well, and I'm looking right now even at the Wii U Virtual Console. There's about 213 games on there. They have the big ones. They have Majora's Mask, Pokemon Snap, Mario Party, all that kind of stuff. But then they have just some weird, obscure games like Wave Race. You remember that shit?
Dude, Wave Race 64 N64 game.
Yeah, I mean, like, and some of the other games that are here, there are some Final Fantasy games, Mega Man, obviously Street Fighter, but I think Street Fighter, you've already got them. Like, we've already got Street Fighter 2, and the big kind of Street Fighter pack is coming soon, so that's fine. But then there's Harvest Moon. Well, that's the Wii U game. Mario Golf. Like, there's a bunch of games here that I just haven't played. Fire Emblem? Earthbound?
Fire Emblems are good games.
Bloody hell.
For sure. Earthbound. Yeah. I think I said Mother Brain, but I think Earthbound is made by the company Mother Brain, now that I think about it.
Yeah. And also think about it, Carrick. I mean, what about Mortal Kombat? Mortal Kombat and the SNES. Like, there's so many games that I remember that aren't on this list.
And if Mortal Kombat, even an old one, was on the fucking Switch, I would probably play it where I would not play it on the Xbox. Like, I don't know why, but the idea of just grabbing a fighter and being like, while doing something, that's actually
And I will
exciting.
Say, though, I think there could be a good chance of that coming, because I remember on the Xbox 360, there was a Mortal Kombat pack.
Yeah.
Where it was, like, you know, the original three and whatever it was. So I think there is a good chance, but it's more about... there was an article about this the other day, and it really resonated with me. It asked whether Nintendo was intentionally holding Virtual Console back. And I think they absolutely are. They might not have that many exclusives out there. Even though this year there are some great exclusives. Like, I think we're getting a Yoshi game, a Kirby game, Mario Tennis. I'm so fucking pumped for that. But we don't have a Super Mario Odyssey. We don't have a Zelda. Like, I think this year they really need to bring out Virtual Console. And, you know, this is preaching to the choir. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it's implemented. I think I'd prefer, in my opinion, either be able to, you know, have this subscription service and individual purchases, or just have individual purchases. I wouldn't just want a subscription service, because I don't know what it is. I like the feeling of owning a game. You know,
and the feeling of not having to be, I mean, what if, I mean, how's it going to check your DRM and stuff if you're on a train and there's no wireless?
Oh, like, there has to be
to rent and buy.
Look at Super Mario Run. You couldn't play that game without being connected. And I couldn't play that game if I was on a train, because it keeps going in and out of service.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's, my hope is that they're smart enough to, that's the thing is, you'll never quite know it. And if it's a single purchase, how much do you charge? Like, that's another big question. Like, how much would you pay? Let's say there's a Mortal Kombat. How much would you pay?
Yeah.
So to me, a membership has a positive, and that's that I can play some games I would never buy at all. Mm. And then to me, purchasing has the positive of I can play the game whenever I want.
Yeah.
So no matter what, like you said, you almost need both. Because if you don't have both, then there's a chance that you'll sort of miss out. But what do you charge somebody? Like, what do you, a Wave Race?
Okay, hold on. This is the question. What? How much do you think Wave Race 64 is on the Wii U Virtual Console?
on the Wii U Virtual Console.
Yes.
I don't know the prices, but I would. I mean, $4.99.
It's so $4. It's $9.99.
Ooh, that's yeah. actually pretty fucking high, to be
now,
honest.
Here's the interesting thing. I mean, I think the Nintendo owned IPs, from what I see on the Wii U Virtual Console, most of them are $9.99. And then the third party mm-hmm. ones go down to $4.99. There is not okay. one game here that is over $10. And I think $10 like max. That
yeah.
cannot go more than that. But yeah, like I understand the benefits of having a subscription. If you're already wanting to play online and it's just a little bit extra every month and you get access to all these games instead of having to buy them individually, because 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, it will add up. For a lot of people. So I just hope that we have the option of both, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, so do I. I don't know. I would have to think about those prices because like
yeah.
there's a experimentation price, I guess is the best way you can describe it. And the all in one is awesome because you can do that. And I have even done it now with Game Pass. So I would say, yeah, the only way to really successfully do it, I think, and please everybody is to have two, but then you really do have to look at prices. I guess if they were charging $4.99 and $9.99, that's probably the only way you could do it. I mean, otherwise yeah. you're barely charging anybody like 99 cents or something. Yeah, that's hard to know where yeah. to split it.
Yeah, and I can see some people that aren't happy with $9.99, but so long as it's not over 10, I think like just keep it under that $10 mark
yeah,
for individual
right,
games.
Yeah, right, right.
And we'll be kosher, sure. Nintendo.
Yeah.
So we are at the end of this podcast. It was still somewhat short, but we had a lot of interesting news. Thank you so much for joining up until this point, Carrick, as always. Thank you.
Yes, that was a blast, of course. Let's talk about LA Noire for an entire podcast next time,
minutes.
Too. Fuck it. We should even title it, like, whatever game we're supposed to cover, and then yeah. just be like, so about LA Noire.
What a great game.
Oh, dude. Yeah, I hear you.
Fantastic. Anyways, guys, thank you so much again for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Peace out.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.